are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Friday, June 26, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Casual Friday. Michael, will you bring down that music and put up my computer, please, for a moment? But it's not just an ordinary Casual Friday. Is my computer up? Matt and the BK, IM'd us right before the show. I was like, I hope you've got a good gay anthem at the ready. And apparently Frankie Goes to Hollywood, at least as far as Time Out New York is concerned. Oh, that was down at the end. I think that was 50. Son of a gun. Wait a second. Number one was A Little Respect by Erasure? I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I know Frankie Goes to Hollywood. Folks, it is Casual Friday. I've already broken format. It's so casual. And joining us, as is the case on every Casual Friday, will be the wonderful Cliff Schechter. And then later, to give us a movie recommendation, I already know what the movie's going to be because he's a filmmaker and he made a movie. Giovanni Zelko, who I think Cliff is actually a, I don't know if he's an official producer on this, but he's on this film, The Algerian. And we'll be talking about, so I just gave away, but we'll be talking about his film. And obviously on the program today, the Supreme Court has decided the marriage equality case that was in front of the Supreme Court. I don't know that this is a huge surprise, but nevertheless, it's a monumentous occasion. The case is Obergefell versus Hodges. And we'll obviously talk more about it with Cliff, but it is whether or not the 14th Amendment, equal protection, the constitutional amendment requires equal protection under the law, whether or not the 14th Amendment ensures that gay and lesbian people have the same right to marriage as straight people do. And although at this point in 36 states, I believe it is, we have marriage equality, it is now, as of about an hour ago, maybe an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours ago, it is now the law of the land. It doesn't matter where you live in the United States. If we have marriage equality. So there you go. and so it's exciting. It's exciting to be you know, to be alive and conscious at this time and be an adult and be aware of, like, wow, this is a very monumentous. I mean, you know, for my daughter, I'll go home, I'll tell her, and she'll look at me like, what? What do you mean? Because from my daughter's perspective, she has friends who have two moms and two dads, and it really, she's just going to look at me like, oh, well, that's good, and not really be aware that it's a new thing in some way. And so we will dig into it with Cliff Schechter. And, you know, part of this is, well, look, the big part of this, obviously, is just simply being aware that we live in a more humane society, an officially more humane society in some respects. And then the other part of it is also sort of watching the right-wingers melt down. That's also enjoyable. I mean, there's no reason not to enjoy every aspect of this. And, of course, the upshot is, too, is that now those of us who are already married, we apparently can date other people. Isn't that what is? Isn't that part of the?
Yeah. Now the, all of a sudden, marriage seems
you got to speak. What say that again?
I said, yeah. Now all of a sudden, marriage seems plausible.
Right.
Yeah.
Because the institution itself has completely been blown.
I mean, if you can now, yeah, now you can see anybody else. It doesn't mean anything.
Right.
There's no real commitment. It's great.
It's fantastic.
Now I can think about it.
It's fantastic. So all that is good. We also will cover yesterday in the House, the trade adjustment assistance passed. All the Democrats voted for it. We'll talk about that with Cliff briefly as well. But that was, you know, the sort of the other shoe to drop, I guess. I mean, trade adjustment assistance, for what it's worth, is a good thing. It supposedly will mitigate parts of these trade deals coming down the block. I don't think it will that much, and that's why, of course, it was used as a sort of a tactical tool by the Democrats. Speaking of tactical tool, I saw Lawrence O'Donnell last night say that it was somehow craven or cynical for them to have voted. I don't know. It seemed it was a very weird take on it. It was a strategy that they tried. It failed, but good. No harm done in terms of trade adjustment assistance. Well, I'll talk more about this with Cliff. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Cliff Schechter. A reminder, folks, your reviews on iTunes make a big difference to us. Head over there right now during this break to iTunes. Give us a review, a couple of stars if you want, but also write up a review. Very helpful to us. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Cliff Schechter.
Devil made me.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, Matt is not with us today. You don't have to roll your eyes, Michael. You're doing a fine job. I just want to make sure I give you a little bit of margin of error. That's all. ladies and gentlemen, before we get to our next guest, we must indeed get to our next guest theme song. And here it is.
Cliff Schachter, Libertas LLC. New media, public relations, and strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schachter, LibertasLLC.com.
Yes, it's Cliff Schachter. Hello, Cliff. How are you?
I'm doing well, Sammy. After a rather bad last week when some terrible things happened, it's been a hell of a week this week. For some good things, not all great, but at least with the Supreme Court. And I'm also mostly on vacation, too, and that's never a bad thing.
Yeah, it sounds like you're on vacation. You got to stay. Are you walking around in a circle? Because your reception's going a little bit in and out. But
I'm actually not. I'm in the house, but I hope you can.
Now we're starting to lose you. Cliff? Ooh.
I'm walking around now. Can you hear me?
Yeah, getting a little bit better. Folks, see the tremendous commitment that Cliff Schachter has, even on vacation. He is joining us. Are you there?
I am.
Okay, that's good.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, that's pretty good. So, Cliff,
I'm not going to move from this spot.
Cliff Schachter will be dipped in amber and will not move. As we discussed, this is a pretty big a day. The 14th Amendment has prevailed.
That is true. I have a couple reactions to this. First of all, obviously, the most important reaction is this is an enormous day. I mean, this is a day up there with any of the major, Brown versus Board of Education and decisions like that in terms of an enormous civil rights victory for a large group of people whose civil rights have been either ignored or in the past purposely denied in this country. And that's huge. Second, I would say, I'm in ground zero right now, because remember the case came out of Ohio and other places. And just so people can feel okay about things, there are no spontaneous human and box turtle marriages going on in the streets. We seem to be getting through this time okay.
You are aware, though, that now as married, as people who are in an existing marriage, you're now allowed to date other people.
Oh, yeah, that was the cool thing about this ruling, too. So hats off to Scalia for sneaking that bit in there.
Yes.
Now he and Dick Cheney can go hunting together all those times they really wanted to. You know what, though? I mean, on a more serious note, obviously, DJK, and that goes without saying, we could go on about that just because it's amazing, and you and I both have many friends that we're very happy for. On a different level, two or three reactions. One is, the majority by Justice Kennedy is so reasoned and so, such a smart decision where he brings legal reasoning in, but emotion into it, and it makes you kind of sit there and scratch your head and wonder how it is on so many other decisions on money and politics and voting rights and guns. He's such an idiot. I don't know how else to put it, because this one is reasoned so well. I guess that's the way it goes. A third reaction of mine is Scalia is outright losing his mind at this point.
Yes.
Somebody wrote about this. I think it was Mike Tomasky in the Daily News.
Cliff. Cliffy, I don't know if it's going to work today, buddy, because we're...
Go on again.
We're losing you as we talk. We may have to reconvene next week.
Hello.
I think you answered that question. Cliff, I will take it from here, and we will reconvene next week. But I don't know if you can hear me. If you can have
hear me, let us know this part.
Cannot hear you, Cliff. But have a good vacation, and we'll talk. I'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye. Well, let's get into let me read from some of the decision today. I'm going to have to go solo today, which is not it's not such a bad thing. I have Michael.
We can ring and fire
here,
it a little
and
bit.
I was going to say Michael seems to know how to work the microphone today, so that we've got that going. But let me just read. Just a little bit from Kennedy, where he talks about the 14th Amendment requiring states. This is from the decision. The 14th Amendment requires states to recognize same-sex marriages validly performed out of state. Since same-sex couples may now exercise the fundamental right to marry in all states, there is no lawful basis for a state to refuse to recognize lawful same-sex marriage performed in another state on the ground of its same-sex character. So, in other words, there you have it in terms of a marriage in one state recognized in another. But this is from the end of his opinion. Or I should say, here's another one. Here's another snippet. The nature of injustice is that we may not always see it in our own times. The generations that wrote and ratified the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment did not presume to know the extent of freedom in all its dimensions. And so they remember, the 14th Amendment was written in 1868, I believe it was. It was definitely in the 1860s. I can't get dates this so well this year, but 1860s. Let's call it 1865, 1868. 1868, of course. It's the 1868 because it's after the war. The 14th Amendment did not presume to know the extent of freedom in all its dimensions, and so they entrusted to future generations a character protecting the rights of all persons to enjoy liberty as we learn its meaning. When new insight reveals discord between the Constitution's central protections and a received legal stricture, a claim to liberty must be addressed. Now, the idea that the Constitution is a living document is one that has been espoused by openly, I should say, by left of center jurists for a long time. Stephen Breyer wrote a whole book on this. And the idea being that nothing or that much of what the future was going to hold could not be known by those who wrote the Constitution, right? I mean, they couldn't have known the size of the country 200 years later. They couldn't have known. They couldn't have known what technology would bring. They couldn't have known. They could not have anticipated every new social dynamic. And so the idea is that the Constitution is constantly reinterpreted through modernity and is updated as modernity arrives, I guess. And this is really not terribly controversial, because how could it be otherwise? How could it be otherwise? Now, I don't know that Kennedy explicitly accepts that notion of the Constitution, but he certainly expressed it there. I mean, he's attempting to express it in the sense that, well, we've changed. The Constitution has stayed the same, but no, the Constitution changes because, of course, we change. And anything that we interpret as human beings, if we have changed, changes. Because the Constitution, I mean, the literal Constitution has not changed. The words have stayed the same. It's still on a piece of parchment. But the meaning has changed. And because in 1868, when the 14th Amendment was written, and this is actually from Scalia's dissent, and I will get to that. Obviously, we had no gay marriage. We had no marriage equality. It's only recently, at that point, the 14th Amendment, like moments, that we didn't have slavery either. Let me go on with what Kennedy has written. No union is more profound than marriage, for it embodies the highest ideals of love, fidelity, devotion, sacrifice, and family. In forming a marital union, two people become something greater than they once were. As some of the petitioners in this case demonstrate, marriage embodies a love that may endure even past death. The case itself was brought by a man whose, husband had passed away. That's not in the, their plea, I'm sorry, it would misunderstand these men and women to say they disrespect the idea of marriage. Their plea is that they do respect it so deeply that they seek to find its fulfillment for themselves. Their hope is not to be condemned to live in loneliness, excluded from one civilization's oldest institutions. They ask for equal dignity in the eyes of the law. The Constitution grants them that right. The judgment of the Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit is reversed. It is so ordered. And thus, we have marriage equality in this country. Now, I'm not a terribly poetic person, and so I don't necessarily appreciate this. I mean, from my perspective, marriage, for all I care, can be an institution outside of government. But we do afford married people certain extra rights. I don't know. Somebody counted them up, like 1,000 extra rights that are available to you if you are married. And in my estimation, the Constitution doesn't necessarily grant people equal dignity in the eyes of the law. It just, the Constitution grants people the same rights to special privileges if it's awarded to one person as to another. And so if government's going to be in the business of sanctifying marriages, you got to do it for everybody. But nevertheless, people seem to appreciate the poetry. I mean, I hate to be the party pooper. But at the end of the day, it's simply about, we all know why gay people didn't have the right to marry as of, across the country as of 3 or 4 hours ago. It was just bigotry, period. And sadly, it took a long time for people to evolve beyond that bigotry to the point where there was a critical mass that forced the issue. And, you know, this didn't just happen naturally. It happened because there were incredibly dedicated and brave activists who for 40 years, probably more actually, but have been fighting for this, have been fighting for these rights. So there's a huge lineage of people who have worked towards this moment. You know, that's incredibly moving. Let's get to some of the dissent by Scalia, because, you know, there's always going to be a part of the population. I mean, look, there's still people who still apparently have a problem with this whole thing where we don't have slaves. I mean, there's... So it's certainly inevitable. Scalia writes, let's get to that, the question of the 14th Amendment. Scalia in the dissent writes at one point, when the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868, every state limited marriage to one man and one woman. And no one doubted the constitutionality of doing so. That resolves these cases. Now, of course, at that time, interracial marriage was banned. And at that time, women were the property of their husbands. In fact, in both those instances, there was laws to that effect on the books as recently, I don't know, as 15, 20 years ago. I think it wasn't until, you know, 20 years ago, maybe the last women are chattel of their husband laws were stripped of the books. I think it's quite possible to actually, I don't know if when my parents got married, my mom was allowed to have a credit card in her own name. I certainly know that, like, I remember in my teens growing up in Worcester where the clerk of the Board of Elections had a problem with women using their birth last name if they were married to vote. I mean, let's get real here. You can't use that as a standard. Unless you're Anton Scalia. At one point, Scalia writes, let me see if I can find this here. There were four separate dissents, I believe, in this in the Obergefell versus Hodges case. I think Scalia joined all of the dissents. He had a problem with all of it. I joined the Chief Justice opinion in full, that being Roberts. So maybe it's appropriate I just read one paragraph of Roberts. If you are among, this is from Roberts' dissent, the last paragraph. If you are among the many Americans of whatever sexual orientation, who favor expanding same-sex marriage, by all means, celebrate today's decision. Celebrate the achievement of a desired goal. Celebrate the opportunity for a new expression of commitment to a partner. Celebrate the availability of new benefits. But do not celebrate the Constitution. It had nothing to do with it. I respectfully dissent. And I, you know, here again, the Constitution does not, as far as I know, mention the word marriage at all. No one has the right to get married under the Constitution. However, if government is going to recognize the marriage of two people, it has to recognize the marriage of other people, unless there's some type of, you know, overarching, compelling state need not to. And that's what equal protection under the law means. So here's Scalia. I join the Chief Justice, Justice's opinion in full. I write separately to call attention to this court's threat to American democracy. If it is of overwhelming importance. Okay, well, here he says, the substance of today's decree is not of immense personal importance to me. The substance is not. It is of overwhelming importance, however, who it is that rules me. Today's decree says that my ruler, capital R, and the ruler, capital R, of 320 million Americans coast to coast is a majority of the 9 lawyers on the Supreme Court. It's as if it's the first time he's recognized the role of the 9 lawyers of the Supreme Court. Maybe he has a problem with them all being lawyers, which I think is actually he's on to something. I don't know if he also remembers the 2000 election, but that was a long time ago. Until the courts put a stop to it, public debate over same-sex marriage displayed American democracy at its best. The irony of him writing this when they stopped the vote counting in 2000 in Florida is, well, I wouldn't say delicious. Prominent. No matter what it was the people ratified, the 14th Amendment protects those rights that the judiciary, in its reasoned judgment, thinks the 14th Amendment ought to protect. So he's saying, I guess what he's saying is that the 14th Amendment is subject to a referendum by Americans and not by a referendum of judges, which has not been the way that the 14th Amendment has been applied up until in every other decision up until this moment. The nature of marriage is that through its enduring bond, two persons together can find other freedoms such as expression, intimacy, and spirituality. And then he quotes from Kennedy's opinion. And he writes, really? Whoever thought that intimacy and spirituality, whatever that means, were freedoms? And if intimacy is, one would think freedom of intimacy is abridged rather than expanded by marriage. In other words, you're supposed to be monogamous. And then he adds, ask the nearest hippie. Now, I think this is genuine evidence of a guy who is now sort of like moved into, I don't know if he used too much, you know, aluminum in his deodorant or what it was, but he's what he's referring to there. And I'm going to explain this to people because I don't even know if you guys get it. Well, you get it. Noah may not get it. There was this thing 50 years ago, literally 50 years ago. Well, I guess actually like 47. Summer of Love was 68, right? Where there was free love with these hippies. And Scalia is still pissed about it. Ask the nearest hippie if marriage hasn't abridged. It's just, wow.
You're saying whatever, like, far out groovy girl Scalia was into back in those days, not inviting him to Woodstock is why we've had to deal with him all these years?
Yep.
I see. That's a fair angle.
They all called me Square. And I didn't get to go to Woodstock. So, there it is. It is Pride marches all across the country this weekend. And so it's going to be pretty pretty crazy. And let me just add this one thing. And this is something hopefully we talk to Ian on Monday. I'm going to ask him about but there's still a lot of states in this country. I don't know how many off the top of my head where you can be fired simply for being gay. Simply for being gay, you could be fired. Which needs to be fixed. I'm curious as to what the implications are if someone is married and they are fired because they are gay. If the fact that they're married becomes the basis for the employer to know that they're gay if they get protection because of their marital status. I mean, that's, you know, that's some small bore sort of parsing stuff there. But we should also tell you that everyone except for Lindsey Graham and Jeb Bush have, in the Republican race, at this point, I think, although I don't know if Donald Trump has, I'd be surprised. It'll be interesting to see when they all come out for the constitutional amendment to outlaw gay marriage, which I got news for you is not going to happen. It's been a very good week for Republican fundraising. But which generally means it's been a very good week for human dignity and for the rest of the, you know, for the country as a whole. With that said, yesterday in the House, the TAA, Trade Adjustment Assistance, passed. I was watching O'Donnell last night, and the way that he sort of like, how unbelievable it was that Democrats voted against it, and then they voted for it. And I don't know why that's so difficult to understand. They voted against it because they thought it was the best way to kill the entire deal. And then when the deal was passed by the Republicans, they voted to mitigate the impact of it to the extent that they could. And then they went on to talk about how there was sufficient changes, in their opinion, sufficient changes to the fast track authority that really opened up the process far more so than processes in the past for passing trade legislation, which seems to me comes from the same place as that tactical maneuver, right? But I don't know. I mean, I just wanted to mention that. I mean, that's the only sort of, and it's not an insignificant one, but other than that, a pretty good week. I mean, King v. Burwell, I think, was decided in the correct way. It would have been, I am not convinced that a lot of those people would have lost their insurance after a short period of time. I think the pressure would have been immense on governors from those states. But nevertheless, it's the implications of, I don't know, that type of ruling. We'll talk to Ian, hopefully, Ian or Scott Lemieux on Monday about those things. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'm going to be talking to Giovanni Zelko. Apparently, Cliff, I mean, he had suggested I talk to Giovanni and watch this movie, which I quite enjoyed. But Cliff is on the poster as a producer.
Hollywood Cliffy.
Yeah, there we go. All right, when we come back, we'll be talking to Giovanni Zelko, the director and writer, co-writer, I believe, of The Algerian. We'll be taking your phone calls and your IMs later in the program. But, you know, good news for the entire country, I think. All right, we'll be right back after this. Ugh.
Easy, any man I want, I'll take him, make him my mind.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Giovanni Zelko. He is the director and the writer of the film The Algerian, of which Cliff Schechter is one of the... Is he a full-on producer, Giovanni?
Yeah, he's definitely one of the producers. We have many, but he is one of our most important.
Oh, well, that sounds that's great. Cliff has gone Hollywood. The film is really I really enjoyed it, and I want to be very careful not to give a spoiler. Because I...
I think so long as you don't give the ending away, everything else is safe.
Right.
Within reason.
I was surprised by the film. I mean, in terms of the film, the story surprised me. I'll leave it at that without having to get... But it's won a lot of awards. The film is about essentially a sleeper cell... in the United States. Give me a sense of why you made this movie.
The movie came about through a series of conversations that Ben Youssef and I had in the mid-2000s. We actually started discussing the idea of having a film that was a post-9/11 response that was dealing with the 19 hijackers while they were living in the United States, and that idea evolved into a film that would take place in the immediate future about a sleeper cell that came to Los Angeles and was embedded as a student at a university while he was waiting for orders to engage in a plot that was an international plot with other cell members from different countries. So that's the genesis of the story. The idea came about because we wanted to explore the rationale behind what sleeper cells were thinking while they were waiting sometimes for years to do a job. So that was the inception.
And we should say that Ben Youssef is the lead actor in the film.
Yes, he's the lead actor. He's also the co-story and co-executive producer on the film. So he and I came up with a story, and then I wrote a screenplay based on that story, and then he and I produced the film together.
I mean, what has always sort of bedeviled me, and I'm obviously not the only person, and I think that, you know, the film captures quite well, is that dynamic of how you could be so determined to launch an attack, I guess, but living amongst those people that you're going to attack for an extended period of time. I know it was at the very least, there was one of the 9/11 attackers who was, well, there was multiple of them who were here for over a year. There was one who also like still had relationships that he had maintained, not necessarily in this country, but with his girlfriend, I think it was in Germany, and he was still in touch with his father. I mean, in the instance of your film, this guy is, in many respects, pretty isolated.
Correct. He was initially, he was very isolated, which was the plan, and he's told to stay away from mosques and to stay away from women in one of the sequences where they're training him. The isolation, just by human nature, starts to diminish because he's in a major metropolis like Los Angeles. So the idea behind creating a character that was in the center of a multitude of other characters, we would slowly have him be introduced to a number of different people from different walks of life. So he encounters and becomes friends with a Marine before he realizes he's a Marine. And he becomes friends with a girl who is of a religious background that he doesn't think she is initially, and, you know, becomes really close friends with her, and he becomes friends with an American Muslim imam that is very liberal, neutral, and a good man, and he walks a solid path and a righteous path, and another Muslim man that he meets who's an immigrant from Syria, and he becomes friends with him, and he becomes like a father figure to him. So essentially what the film is doing, it has an isolated individual who was, shall we say, brainwashed into extremist thoughts, and he is slowly deprogrammed from his initial thought patterns, his initial idea of why he hates America so much and why he wants to do harm. And as he's immersed in major metropolis like Los Angeles, but he could play in New York City, Boston, Chicago, or even small towns, he becomes friends with these people, and he starts having emotional reactions and attachments to them, whether lovers or good friends. And he is slowly deconstructed back to a center, and he finds his moral compass by that virtue.
I mean, it's interesting too, because he is. I mean, you say he's brainwashed. I mean, talking about the lead, but it was interesting to me that the primary impetus for his at least openness to engaging in this was not religious per se, but arguably political and certainly very personal in some respects too, right? I mean,
correct, yeah. One of the things that we wanted to do as filmmakers is not make this a movie about a religious right-wing fundamentalist terrorist cell. They happen to be Muslim, but their entire motive is a political one. It's a very specific one. And I went to great lengths in writing the screenplay to sculpt out and carve out their ideology in very clear terms, so that the audience is aware that yes, they're Muslim, but they could have been Basque Christians, or they could have been the Irish Catholics. So the idea wasn't a religious one. We wanted to deconstruct the idea of Muslim terrorists. Like, no, human being, political identity issue, political ideology that they're trying to profess. So the idea of the main characters, the main cell character called Father, his idea politically is to create a caliphate, which is not a new idea. Obviously, ISIS has picked up on it, and to unify Muslim countries into one singular entity, sort of what the Crusader states were doing in Europe under Pope Urban II. When he called for the First Crusade, he created the idea of a singular Christian ideology as a form of Europe moving to recapture Jerusalem. So, as a comparison, so we tried doing that as a political movement, not a religious one. So you're right in that, and it was important to have the main character Ali buy into that political idea of removing the West, i.e., the United States, from its embedded nature in the Middle East, and also part of it is his own personal revenge. His father and his mother were killed, we learn early on in the film, because they were dissidents in their own country, as their political perspective was not in line with the government. So,
and I mean, it seems on some level open too, as to whether or not, I mean, and maybe I'm just, watching it, imposing my own knowledge of how the U.S. operates in some of these countries. I'm thinking Yemen in particular, that, I guess in retrospect it's unclear. I was convinced it was a drone attack that.
Bravo, exactly. But 20 years ago, we weren't using drones. So right, the film shows 20 years ago. But there were other methods, and it wasn't. In that particular instance, because we're dealing with Algeria 20 years ago, it was the Algerian government that was basically rooting out essentially the Muslim Brotherhood in Algeria as dissidents of the political hierarchy at the time. So even when they won a landslide political win for their party, the government just dismissed the voting and just revoted. And so that's what that was in reference to. So anyone that was familiar, anyone in France or Algeria who's very familiar with the Algerian struggle in the past 34 years since their emancipation from the colonial power of France will know what that reference is to. But it's not important for the general audience. They just need to know that.
No, it's funny because I just sort of collapsed time. And I think it immediately to me is this is a dynamic that I think people are quite familiar with. I mean, even as recently.
It's happening today.
As recently as a couple of months ago, John Brennan was saying that on some Sunday morning show that, you know, we can create terrorists. We have to be careful because we can create terrorists by our so-called counterterrorism. And in many respects, I mean, that is a dynamic that this took place in Algeria 20 some odd years ago. But it's a dynamic that's been taking place over the past 10, 15 years in places like Pakistan and Yemen and
Exactly. I mean, you name a Middle Eastern country, and at some point in their recent history, dissidents have been, you know, almost crushed by the government and essentially creating terrorist fringe groups. I mean, ISIS is essentially an amalgamation, as you know, of a multitude of different groups from across Syria and Iraq, and cleverly amalgamated into one singular unit, but they all have the same kind of crossover, shall we say, that they want to create their own state because they're ultimately unhappy with the state they're living in. And there's a danger in that if you're taking a position as a government to completely oppress the voices of your population, eventually it's going to come back on you.
What kind of research did you guys do in terms of the psychology of a sleeper cell? I mean, it's interesting to me because I you know, there was just a report that came out, I guess, a couple of days ago that showed that in fact there's far more threat from domestic terrorism in this country than sort of international terrorism in terms of the lives lost. And to juxtapose the idea of like a guy a sovereign citizen living in the States, in some ways that sovereign citizen does not hide his intentions. He's just the crank down at the end of the street who is has got his shooting range and is driving around talking about how the government is the real problem. And then just one day he goes and tries to shoot up a federal building or something. In this instance, your character is both simultaneously submerged in a society and isolated, but I guess in a different way, and I guess in some ways, I mean, that's what this whole story about is, like, you know, the ability of that guy to maintain that mission.
Correct. And to the final moments of what is he going to do? What are his options? What can he do? The film functions on many different levels, and you've touched on a number of different ones. It's also important to understand that at the core of this story, it's about a human being, it's about a man, and there's a love story that is centered in the film in which everything else starts revolving around. And as his humanity comes out, as filmmakers, our message starts to come out, which is, it's kind of, I hate to call it a kumbaya moment, but it's about the ability of coexistence, the possibility of coexistence, even in extreme situations where it's not, people don't think it's feasible. So that hope is always there. It's not a perfect world, as we know, and there are a lot of problems, obviously, in a cross-cultural dynamic issue, especially with the East colliding with the West as it is today. And with the embers of the Arab Spring forming groups like ISIS, there's some, like, serious problems out there. But the film deals with the film basically opens a dialogue for people to think about not just their position, about the other position. So what we wanted to do is take a mirror up to society and let it see itself. So we show the good and the bad of all different sides. The American side, the good and bad, and the good and bad of the Muslim side and other groups in the film that we represent, so that the audience can think about it when they leave. They can judge for themselves and realize that it's not always a one-dimensional, myopic view on the world and cultures, especially in a place like the United States or like in Europe, where we have like this huge cross-cultural cities where many different people are, you know, colliding ideas as they have for centuries. Obviously, just this morning, I'm sure you saw in France what happened with beheading, another ISIS-style attack in France 6 months after the Charlie Dodd. So it's a serious problem, and it's occurring around us constantly. And I think the film is very timely because it's dealing with the big white elephant in the room that no one else seems to want to talk about, which is that there is an issue with extremists, and people need to look at the root of the issue and not just try and remove it, because it's really hard to remove it at this point, because there's a lot of people that are embedded in our countries, as you mentioned, that are our own citizens. They look like us and talk like us and think like us, but they don't always agree.
Where, people can obviously check out the trailer and more on the movie at the AlgerianMovie.com. We're going to put a link up at majority.fm. Where are people going to be able to see this in theaters, on Netflix? When's that happening?
It's going to be in theaters July 17th. We start rolling out our theatrical release here in the United States. So at present, we're in 22 cities. And AMC, I think, just listed us a couple days ago. So we're just dialing in exactly which cities it's going to open in first. We're thinking perhaps D.C. or New York and L.A. But within the next week or so, we'll know exactly where and when. And it'll be up on our website. And we'll start doing a lot more press with the cast as well as myself to get the word out there. And, you know, a film like ours that started off as just like a small indie film, with a small budget, we went the distance. I mean, we put together a tremendous cast, which is extremely important, that we're able to really dig into a very powerful script, very powerful story, and a lot of dedicated people in front of the camera, behind the camera, brought it to fruition. And it's not common. I watch movies all the time. I go to festivals. I can't remember the last time I saw a film that won 19 awards at film festivals. It's very unique.
I'm literally looking at the your festival award page as we speak, and there was in another life. I was I did that independent film circuit, and it's really impressive the places that you won and the awards that you've won. For the film, and certainly deserve it. So people should check it out. Thank you for coming on and talking about it. And I'm very excited.
Thanks for having me, Sam. Appreciate it.
Very excited to be able to rub
out. I'll make sure I get you guys a bunch of tickets for your fans and see if they go out and
see where
they're at.
Yes, it's just it's worth it. Just from I think the perspective of folks on the show to get Cliff Schechter to be a big.
Yeah, that's right. Cliff's been amazing. He's been a huge asset to all of us. So it's a huge team effort. And, you know, the deal with film, it's like it's not just one person.
Yes.
It's hundreds of people making it happen. So everyone's involved.
Giovanni Zelko, the film is The Algerian, and you can check it out at thealgerianmovie.com. Thanks again, Giovanni.
Thank you, sir. Have a great weekend. Talk to you soon.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
It's a good film. It's a good film. And I think people know I don't say that lightly. I don't say this lightly either. I'm very excited.
Not to be petty here, but you were up and that was ready to go.
What do you mean?
I mean your sound, whatever you played that off of, the 360 or your computer.
No, that was on my computer.
Well, it was up.
All right.
Ready to go.
Michael's trying
just
to make
duly a... noted.
Folks.
Is that really the song, though?
What do you mean?
To celebrate today?
No, probably not.
Yeah,
it's just the one.
I mean, it's good, but I think we need to expand our portfolio here.
We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program, wherein... do we have any sound today? Oh, well, at the very least, we're going to talk about... It's fascinating what's happening with Bernie Sanders right now. And let me just give you, you know, we played some of the sound yesterday.
How do you want to, we're going to do this in the fun half or no?
Yeah, we'll do it in the fun half.
Okay.
But I want to tease just why I think we're seeing this. We're actually seeing Bernie Sanders being attacked now from the right and the left. From the right, coming from Claire McCaskill. And I got to say, I heard part of it yesterday. Heard more of it today, and I'm just shocked. I'm just shocked they're already feeling like they need to go to this place already, and shocked as to like who it, it I'll tell you what scares me about this is that there is, and again, I said this yesterday, it's quite possible Claire McCaskill is out there freelancing. Okay? She's a surrogate for Clinton, but the dynamic is it's not like the campaign is sitting there and giving her talking points and she walks out and does it. When you've got a sitting senator, the lines of communication are not exactly what it is. If it's even, you know, I think I mentioned this the other day, you know, Lanny Davis goes out there and says something stupid and he may have been very supportive of the Clintons in the past and they, you know, still have maintained some type of relationship with him. You know, they slowly get word to him like, Lanny, you may not be helping us.
Top priority this cycle for Hillary is having Lanny Davis say nothing.
That's pretty high. But Claire McCaskill really went out there and said some really stupid stuff. I mean, I'm not just saying stuff that I disagree with. I'm saying stuff that I think just seems to be really tone deaf and showing a broad lack of understanding of who's going to show up and vote in this Democratic primary. Meanwhile, Martin O'Malley, in what I think we had said this just moments before we saw this, made a smart attack on Bernie Sanders, not one that necessarily resonates with me, but a smart attack on Bernie Sanders from the left, which was Bernie Sanders' position on guns. But all of this is coming because there are – yesterday I'd read a poll. Bernie Sanders had come within, I think it was 25 points of Clinton as of about a week or two ago in New Hampshire and in Iowa. Well, today NOAA showed me a poll. NOAA did. That I was looking at Michael. NOAA showed me a poll.
I think they got it.
Yeah, okay. NOAA showed me a poll released yesterday, poll by CNN and WMUR, which I believe is a New Hampshire television station or radio station. Radio station, I believe. The poll has Sanders receiving 35%. Of likely Democratic voters, Clinton's at 43%. Now, she was at 43%, I think, the other day, right? Or 54%. It doesn't matter. The idea that this race is 8 percentage points in New Hampshire, now, granted, it's early, but at this time, June 2007, Clinton was up over Obama by 14 points in New Hampshire. She ended up winning by 3 points. Now, and that was quite a comeback, too. Remember, he won Iowa. She had, I think that was when she had the big sort of emotional response and people sort of rallied back around her. I mean, I think the Clintons tend to do better when they are sort of perceived as the underdog. But I don't know how Sanders is going to do in Iowa, but as of that last poll, he was doing as well in Iowa as he was in New Hampshire. Now, I don't know. This is a New Hampshire-specific poll, and I imagine we're going to see some new Iowa polls any day now. But something's happening here, and you know, when you listen to Claire McCaskill, you get a sense that at the very least, if not the Clinton campaign, the Clinton supporters are very conscious of what's happening. Their response, in my estimation, not the smartest one. We got to take a quick break. We will be back in just a moment. So we'll say goodbye to the freebies, head into the better half of the program. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me via the app at majorityapp.com. That's where you pick it up. We'll be right back after this.